This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Over 1,000 kilometers north of Prince George in the Northwest Territories, along the east bank of the Mackenzie River, is the community of Norman Wells. From there, a 12-inch pipeline runs 870 kilometers south to Zama City, Alberta, carrying crude oil. While that pipeline, built in the mid-80s, has a design capacity of 50,000 barrels a day, a smaller one preceded it, as oil has been flowing out of this region since the early 1920s. While this resource extraction has been ongoing in the Saulteaux-Dene Métis territory for over 100 years now, production is finally starting to wind down as discussion around Indigenous sovereignty and land claims have gained traction in more recent times. Talks to determine just how the oil wells in this region are to be dismantled and reclaimed are on the table between the Saulteaux-Dene Nation and the Métis Nation in the area, with Imperial Oil. Facilitating aspects of these discussions is Indigenous Community Engagement Specialist Annie King, who completed her Master's of Arts in Natural Resources and Environmental Studies, with a focus on geography, at UMBC here in Prince George, Claylie-Dene. She patched into our studio on Earth Day to talk about her work with the Saulteaux Land and Water Board and as a research associate at the University of Northern British Columbia. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you want to throw us a little background of some of the oil wells that exist up in the Northwest Territories and just how long they have been operating for?
For hundreds of years, the local Indigenous people, the Dene at the time, were aware of oil. There was one place in the banks where oil would seep out of the riverbanks, and they called that Tlegotle, which in the local language means the place where oil is. And then when Alexander Mackenzie came along in the 1700s, he also noted it in his travel logs. But it wasn't until 1919, I believe, that Imperial Oil, the company, finally drilled a well in what's now called Norman Wells. They drilled their first well, and they called it Discovery. Drilled it, and then it started producing oil. They ramped up production in the 40s to account for the Second World War, and then tapered off again. And then in the 80s, there was a huge expansion, I think more than tripling production. They created six islands in the middle of the Mackenzie River so that they could drill for more oil below the Mackenzie River. And it was a huge change. It was a drastic increase in production. And the size of the town in Norman Wells also got much bigger. It's been running ever since, but Imperial Oil just referred themselves to environmental assessment, so they've essentially signaled that they are planning to close.
And now we're looking at the industry in that area winding down for these wells.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a reclamation process. Now, for a well that has been operating for roughly 100 years, which is an incredible lifespan for for an oil well, what does reclamation look like? What does it involve? Do you have to get backhoes in there and remove thousands of cubic meters of earth and then mitigate and process that earth into something that is not toxic and replace it? Is it far more simple than that? Or what do you have to do to reclaim an oil well that's been operating for 100 years?
You've hit the nail on the head with a lot of it. The thing that I think makes this reclamation noteworthy beyond others is that it's happening in such a remote area, an area that doesn't have road access for 8 months a year. So any big backhoes and equipment that they need to get up there has to be driven up during winter road season when the roads are built. And there is the issue of what do we do with all this contaminated soil? And so one question is, do we bring it down south to treat it? Do we store it in perpetuity in the Northwest Territories? How would we go about storing it? Who would care for it in perpetuity? There's a bunch of questions about how to proceed with the reclamation. In 2022, Imperial Oil proposed that they build a waste management facility to store a lot of that waste. but people were really concerned because that hadn't been a conversation that had taken place yet about what we do with all the waste. And one of the big questions is, do we leave the 6 artificial islands in the Mackenzie River, or do we take them out? And all of these are conversations that have yet to happen.
There's so many moving parts. Where are you at in the stage now? What are you able to proceed with the reclamation?
Right now, Imperial has been like slowly decommissioning their inactive wells and taking things apart and shipping them south as they're able to. So the production has been ramping down for a few years now. That has begun. The other thing that's sort of been happening since 2016 is the beginning of conversations about closure. Imperial Oil has started trying to rebuild their relationship with the local indigenous people. But right now, they don't even have closure permits filed with the local regulatory boards, the Satu Land and Water Board, because they have to do a lot more engagement with local people before they can really proceed with much. So they have a lot of engagement ahead of them and consultation, and then a lot of regulatory stuff. And then the physical reclamation can start taking place. But right now it's sort of decommissioning equipment and sending it south.
Can you describe what is the role of the Satu Land and Board and how did it came to be created?
So in the 70s, the treaty that was in the region, I believe it was Treaty 11, was overturned because the Supreme Court of the Northwest Territories ruled that the local people hadn't had sufficient understanding of the treaty that they had signed. So Treaty 11 was overturned, which made way for new treaties. So in the 70s through the 90s, there was a bunch of negotiation. And in 94, a new treaty was signed for the area called the Satu, Dene, and Métis Comprehensive Land Claim Agreement. And there's a smattering of others across the Northwest Territories. So land claims are like modern treaties. And that land claim created the Satu Land and Water Board, among a bunch of other things. But one of the big things that came out of the land claim was the Land and Water Board. And the Land and Water Board is just the permitting agency for any development work up north in the Satu region. So any company that wants to come in has to do some engagement with locals, apply to the Land and Water Boards, and then receive approval or get denied or be told they need to give more information before they're allowed to proceed with their project. So the Land and Water Board doesn't monitor or make sure that anything is being done after it's been built, but they are there to approve or deny plans. And then the Canada Energy Regulator is usually who makes sure that those plans are followed.
So it sounds to me like the Land and Water Board is a mechanism that helps assert some sovereignty over what does or does not happen within the territory. Is that an accurate assessment?
Absolutely. And it's under a really interesting model that's not practiced very, very far and wide. There's a few examples in Australia and mostly Northern Canada. It's called co-management, and it's 50% federal and provincial and 50% Indigenous-led. So any decision is made by a board that is half Indigenous and half appointed by the federal government. So it's a really advanced mechanism for asserting rights over their territories.
Since these wells were initially developed by Imperial Oil, who we probably more commonly recognize as Esso Imperial, mm-hmm. Esso gas stations, the development of these wells has been a complex historical legacy for people within the Northwest Territories to deal with. I'm sure there's probably some open wounds. However, as parties are beginning to assert the impacts of this type of development in our nation's northern regions, does it look from your perspective that there are some interesting opportunities to further assert sovereignty of the Satu, Dene, and Métis peoples over this project now that this development is starting to wrap up or come to a conclusion? The situation looks quite different now around the bargaining table than it did 100 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. 100 years ago, there wasn't even a bargaining table. Local people weren't even aware necessarily of what was happening when the first oil well was being drilled. They knew that oil was there, but they didn't view it as a resource to be exploited. So there was some surprise 100 years ago. And there's been kind of a growing fight against the oil field ever since. In the 70s and 80s, there was this big push in something called the Berger Inquiry against a pipeline in the north.
For reference, at the time, that was the proposed Mackenzie Valley pipeline.
And that was partly successful. So Indigenous peoples have been gaining rights throughout this last century and have been more and more able to assert those rights. But now we're sitting in a position where there's this very strong, the Land and Water Board, so there's this very clear mechanism that asks for agreement. It asks for a lot of compromise between parties. So Imperial Oil won't be able to just publish a closure plan and go, this will work for you guys, because the local people have a good deal of power through the Land and Water Board and the land claim. So there's a real opportunity in this closure for the wants and desires of Satu communities to be upheld. The complicating factor, I suppose, is that not everybody in those communities wants the same thing. So finding a balance between everybody's voices and needs will be challenging, but I think that it will ultimately be a very good thing for the Satu people.
I'm thinking of a project that happened just outside of Yellowknife, the giant mine, which was a gold mine, which I believe operated at its height in sometime in the 1970s, but left behind a massive amount of arsenic tailings. And the community still deals with that historic waste, and there is an elaborate method of keeping that waste contained within the surrounding permafrost. The challenges containing that waste are likely to continue centuries from now. And when we're looking at these projects that you are looking at here, I have to imagine that your outlook is better than that, but I'd like to know how much better from your perspective.
I want to be very hopeful. However, I have a good measure of apprehension that the federal government will back the Indigenous communities. The federal government has a 1/3 stake in the oil field, and I'm concerned, I think, to an extent, about the perpetual care of the waste. I think it'll be better than the giant mine. I have the impression that this problem of perpetual care won't be as big of an issue in the future with projects that are initiated now or perhaps 5-10 years ago. But because this is such an old project, there haven't been ongoing steps to manage and mitigate the danger of the waste. And so I do think that there will be some issues with perpetual care, and I think there might be issues with enforcing adequate planning from the federal government side, but I have a great deal of hope that we'll get a high-quality closure that leaves people feeling safe. I think that it's important to at least think about the local people and how deeply their lives are affected by the oil field. And not just the people who live in the town right next to it, but the people who live downriver or on a nearby lake, the wildlife of the region that these people have hunted for millennia now drink from polluted waters. And people downriver have been noting higher rates of cancer and of skin issues when they swim in the river. And there are other connections with human health and environmental health with the oil field that go far beyond my understanding, but that the local people have been feeling for a century, and they are a strong and well-informed people who are going to make sure that their needs are taken care of. And I really hope that they're able to exercise the land claim and the Land and Water Board to the fullest extent.
Do you have any optimism that these talks will have an impact on the way that other companies in the future, whether they're exploring petroleum or mining or some other development, may consider the way they approach their own projects in the future? Do you have any hopes that this may change the way things are done in the future?
I really do. I think that because the land claim is so new, it's 30 years old, we have the tools, but seeing this happen in action might create a roadmap for other companies to go, oh, we want to do this well, we just didn't know how to do it well. And so now having this relatively high profile example of a century-old oil field owned by Imperial Oil being closed, and if Imperial does a good job with their engagement and consultation, that could just be a roadmap that future companies can go, oh, okay, these are the steps I need to take. And I really do think that a lot of companies mean well and and do want to do things correctly and just don't know how to do so. So I'm hoping this closure plots a course.
Thanks so much for sharing that.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. You've been listening to UMBC Research Associate Annie King, who holds a master's in natural resources and environmental studies with a focus on geography. She's working with the Satu Land and Water Board, mitigating environmental harms from historical and current petroleum exploration in the Northwest Territories of Canada in the area of Norman Wells on Satu, Dene, and Métis territories. Thank you so much for your time, Annie. We wish you luck in your research and your work.
Thank you so much. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.